Before today's episode, we would like to begin by addressing one of the most important stories in the football world right now. Having completed a transfer from Nantes to Cardiff, a private plane carrying Emiliano Sala and pilot David Ibbotson disappeared from radar last Monday evening while travelling back to Wales from France. Extensive searches were carried out on Tuesday and Wednesday before being called off on Thursday, having found no trace of the aircraft. Guernsey Harbour Master Captain David Baker says the decision was a difficult one to make, but the chances of survival were extremely remote. A GoFundMe campaign has since raised over €300,000, enough for the family of Emiliano Sala to fund two boats and continue a private search. A link will be left in the description of this episode, and thoughts of everyone at Squawker with the friends and families of both Sala and David Ibbotson at this extremely difficult time. We would also like to show solidarity with the players and fans of Nantes and Cardiff and all other clubs around the globe, in hoping that some news of the incident can be found. Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Squawker Talker. This week's podcast is brought to you by BetBall, the betting app that allows punters to bet together and win together. BetBall will also be sponsoring all of Squawker's deadline day content on January 31st, bringing you the latest deals, the stats you need to know about your club's new signings. But before we begin all of that, we've some very tasty FA Cup business to take care of. And joining me in review of this weekend's football and looking ahead to the bumper BetBall deadline day bonanza is a pair of Squawker Talker legends.
Say that three times fast.
One of which you've just heard from, Mohamed Bahr. How are you?
Look, the sun is shining. Deadline day is coming up. We had a great weekend of FA Cup action. I'm feeling very good.
And to the right of Mo, I had to work out my directions there. I've got well confused about being at the opposite side of the room, is Mr. Will Hall, Chief Squawk Editor. How are you?
Very well. Excited to be beginning the march towards deadline day with you guys.
Yeah, and a march it is. But as I said, before the march, we had some drama in the FA Cup. Who said the magic was dead? 58 places, and this is the first stat, and as with FA Cup, we always get to talk about the pyramid. 58 places between Wimbledon and West Ham, who were stunned at King's Meadow on Saturday. There were plenty of other shocks. Everton's fell victim to a giant killing at the Den, with Murray's 94th minute winner for Millwall. All in all, it was quite an incredible weekend, those results. But let's start with that West Ham game before we move on to Millwall, the good and the bad from that game, which we will address. Who let Pellegrini down in that defeat? Because, 4-2, Wimbledon weren't in the best of form themselves. That is...
No.
This gets filed under embarrassment.
Oh, really? In the predictions... Squawk Prediction article, myself and Sam Long both predicted like big wins for West Ham. Sam is a Wimbledon fan, so you can imagine how happy he was. It's a shame he's not on this week's podcast. King's Meadow is some Game of Thrones kind of name, man. And that was like Drogon massacring the Lannister army, you know, on the field of battle. It was brutal. It was honestly, Masuaku was terrible. I think if you had to point the blame to one player in particular, I think really everyone was kind of bad, but in particularly Masuaku got caught out time and time again by Wimbledon's crossing, by Wimbledon's passing, had no idea what he was doing defensively and didn't offer any of the brilliant attacking play that he usually does to balance that out. Ogbonna wasn't very good. Obiang obviously got rinsed for the second goal and then got taken off at halftime. McCarroll was he even there?
It was a triple substitution at halftime as well.
It was so weird because, I mean, obviously Pellegrini did get the reaction he wanted with his subs in the sense that they turned the game around, looked more bright in the second half and everything. But the fact that he even had to make those subs, like you said, 58 places, they should have had enough quality and enough coherence. And it seemed like that's what was missing most, if you're being honest. It was coherence in the backup players that he played, you know? And Adrian looked kind of weird. I don't know is he had a haircut or something?
Grown his hair out.
He looks
We've not seen him for a while.
So he looks really weird. I was like, who is that? Curtains. Oh, God, it's Adrian. Yeah. But that was very bad from West Ham. On every conceivable level, that was a horror show.
But at least Arnautovic signed a day contract extension afterwards. Quite funny. Looking at Wimbledon, as we said, the West Ham, it's pretty hard to analyse something that was just so quite poor. So this is where you should be giving credit to the team that beat them. So, Will, were there Wimbledon players that impressed you the most watching that game?
Scott Wagstaff's the first one to mention there, obviously, if he scored two goals. Anyone who watched Match of the Day knows how rare that is. So the stat being that this is the first brace of his career, also sort of doubles his goal scoring tally for his last 45 games. And yeah, aside from his goals, one thing he said, well, he was obviously, having scored the two goals, the cameras went to him after the game for the post-match interviews, asked him about his game plan. And the first thing he says is that we were instructed by manager to don't show West Ham any respect. And so beside the two goals, another sort of symbolic moment of just how Wimbledon managed to overcome the West Ham team was the moment towards the end where he's played the ball on the outside of the wing and he could be forgiven for dribbling. I think it's like the 89th minute or something, because it's just before they score their fourth goal through Sebic, where instead of dribbling into the corner and sort of running the clock down, he slides the ball in for, I think it might have been Nightingale from midfield, who stands the ball up and then Sebic ends in. So, yeah, a mention for him, who has just summed up exactly how Wimbledon managed to overcome West Ham, yeah.
Weren't happy with a 3-2.
Great beard, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's soon to change colour, of course, as the BT reporters were straight away asking him about his pledge to sort of dye his beard blue and white after the game.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
Yep. Also, having spoken to Sam Long, who's not here, of course, regular listeners will know of Sam. He's obviously a Wimbledon fan, so it's a point not to have him here with us today. But he singled out Nightingale in midfield, who's, I think, actually a defender, sort of filling in due to injury problems. And Aaron Ramsdale in goal, who has just joined them on loan, I believe, from Bournemouth.
I thought he was going to Juventus.
I think that's his third appearance or something. 20-year-old keeper will be a bit disappointed with the free kick conceded against Felipe Anderson for, I think, West Ham's second, maybe? Yeah. But then in injury time, makes two, a strong intervention and a strong save from Mikel Antonio. So, yeah.
Collective
stock should rise after that performance.
Collective effort with some strong individual displays to lead it. As you said, if they, for that fourth goal, they didn't score it and West Ham countered from dribbling, it's one of those decisions.
Well, exactly, because West Ham came close to scoring twice in stoppage time, as I've explained there. So,
but it paid off and they are through. West Ham, as I said jokingly, stitched up, really. There's no way you get over a result like that. But Arnautovic is staying, and it was...
I think that's a mistake. I think they should have sold him when they had the chance. But, I mean, I suppose it is technically good news after what was... I mean, that's a horrific loss. Antonio should have scored, by the way. He had two chances in stoppage time. He should have at least scored one goal. It was... it's a weird game from Pellegrini, because obviously the side showed the potential that they have under him, but at the same time,
a typical West Ham.
Yeah, really, really.
So let's move on from that game. And before we talk about Everton and Millwall, we should note that the footage circulating on Saturday appearing to show racist chanting among a section of Millwall fans, as well as the pre-match violence, both of which will be subject to an FA investigation. Millwall have released a statement saying anyone identified and found guilty will be banned for life. Meanwhile, Kick It Out call for swift and decisive action against the perpetrators, whilst adding the racist chanting heard from some Millwall supporters during yesterday's match, obviously not yesterday, is disgusting and typical of mass discriminatory chants that continue to go unpunished. So, quick word on that being banned for life is correct on that, isn't it?
That's good.
We've just said FA Cup returned. We saw some of the magic from it in the results, but it was completely marred by...
It's a bit... It's obviously, I'm not saying they're great guys for doing this. Obviously, it's the right thing to do. But to say that they'll be banned for life immediately without, no questions asked, we find the guys who do it, they'll be banned for life. That's at least a step in the right direction, because it'll be like, oh, we'll have a look, we'll do our own investigation, or they just quite swept it under the rug after the big media furor. So they've said, look, we're going to ban them for life. Now, that obviously the best thing is to create a culture where racist chanting doesn't even happen. Mm. That's the first thing, through education and through just, general getting rid of the bad eggs. But it's good that they're being so decisive about it, because you can't have that. It's unacceptable. So to just come out and say, look, the guys that are caught, banned for life, and that's it, draw a line under it, move on.
And even before it, the violence was pretty gruesome. There's that picture circulating of the Everton fan that was took a bit of a slash.
Yeah, violence is a weird thing because it's like, it seems like it's so hard to eradicate from footballing culture. Like, and it's not just England. It's not, you know, people say, England have an issue, sure, but there's in Italy, there's fan violence in everywhere, really. And it just seems like it's some of those things that's maybe embedded in just the violence of society that it becomes intertwined with football. So it's not good. All we can do is condemn it. But like, I don't really know what you could do, what steps you can take, apart from, again, just banning people for life. But the violence doesn't even happen in the grounds that often. Yeah, exactly. It's outside the grounds. So it's very hard.
I think the story as well before that happened this weekend about the MLS fan that's looking to export hooliganism to MLS. I think he's not really going to get many supporters that weekend. But back, so we wanted to obviously focus on that because it is important. It's part of football, as we said. But moving on to the pitch... Everton fans are starting to have lost patience with Marco Silva now. And Silva himself urged his players to be more mature. Is that what that team is lacking with the likes of Jordan Pickford in goal, who is very... We've been big fans of Jordan Pickford. He does some things very well, but he's very eccentric and erratic, and sometimes that lack of calm is maybe shining through now.
He seems just very impulsive, which is weird because for an impulsive guy, he was unusually hesitant. That's actually why the goals went in, I think, because I think the first goal that crossed, if he comes and claims that or challenges for that ball, that goal doesn't go in. He sort of comes and then stops, and then the ball then eventually just loops over him. It was weird sort of indecision. And then the second goal, again, he comes out, but he doesn't come out with any real authority and just sort of sticks his leg at it and makes it a half save. It's kind of the same thing that led to Origi's winner in the Liverpool game, in the derby, because it was just sort of like this hesitance. Normally, when Pickford is good, he's very decisive and he has this sort of big personality. Like you say, he's almost kind of eccentric, but in that sort of forceful way that most of the great goalkeepers of all time are.
That's the classic goalkeeper trait.
That's what you want, but it seems like he still has this sort of hesitance to him where it's like, I can see it. You can label it as maturity if you want to. You know, a mental weakness. I don't know how you would label it, but he does seem like there are moments where he just sort of thinks, oh, wait, should I? Oh, I shouldn't. And then when you second guess yourself as a goalkeeper, especially someone like Pickford who doesn't have the size to get himself out of trouble, you know, it's that they get caught. And, you know, that's what happened. That's all that happened. That first goal, there's no, you know, if he makes a decisive decision, that goal doesn't go in. If he's more decisive with the second goal, the goal doesn't go in. If he commands his backline better, the goal doesn't go in the first second goal as well. So I absolutely agree with Marco Silva. It's a matter of maturity, a matter of experience, and, you know, which is why I think people getting impatient with him already are a bit. You've got to think more than one season at a time. You know, they're not going to go down, so just think more than one season at a time.
Yeah, I guess that's the Sam Allardyce will be loving. All the events unfolding, but they played a strong team as well. Just looking back at pretty much first choice.
Yeah, they should have won.
Their argument would be, and perhaps it's not a strong argument to base the whole result on that, but there was obviously controversy for the second goal. Everton fans might. The ones that aren't too upset by the result might say that if VAR was being used at the ground, they'd be in the hat for the next round. So is it fair that VAR is only being selectively used in the FA Cup? Should it be across every game or none at all, Will?
Well, this is kind of the story because of how furious Marco Silva was with this particular element of the defeat. As Mo's said already, or alluded to already, they didn't deserve to win. It's unfair. Well, they can feel hard done by because of the decision would most likely have been overturned. But I think they only really managed to create like two or three chances themselves throughout the game. And yeah, they'll be annoyed that they came undone against three set pieces, which is something they've struggled from often under Marco Silva of late. It's certainly the source of much frustration. But coming back to the question as to whether it's fair to use... VAR in only certain games, it's obviously not completely fair. It doesn't create a level playing field, but it's very difficult to have that playing field when there's so much resource, so much varying levels of resource and skill involved in these matches. I think they've obviously selected six games for this round and nine games for the previous one, all of which are at Premier League stadiums because they're the only grounds that they've been able to equip with the necessary number of cameras to sort of satisfy all the angles they need for the technology. And I think last season's experiment with was less extensive and cost about $5 million. And the FA, without sounding too much like an FA apologist, the FA is a not-for-profit organisation that's far less, drives far less money revenue than competitions like the Premier League and Champions League, neither of which have VAR. The issues are resource-based, I imagine, and the fact that we're told it's in this experimental phase.
Yeah.
All of that said, it is a pretty elitist look just to equip the Premier League game stadiums with the technology. There are grounds in the Championship, and maybe not any lower than the Championship, but you could potentially install the technology there.
Well, surely the limiting the experiment to just Premier League, surely they need to experiment if they can use it at these grounds. That would be
an
argument.
Well, this is it, because once they've come out of this experimental phase, they've got to address the not very simple matter of like installing it at about 64 stadiums.
Yeah.
There's two solutions that seem obvious to me, neither of which have really been addressed by the FA in any sort of formal statement I've seen. One of which, you could just use it from an advanced stage of the competition where there's fewer teams. All of them will be there by merit, so it sort of eradicates the issue of unfairness to an extent, and just have it from the quarterfinal stage onwards, for instance. Or you could just draw the games randomly from a hat and sort of implement the technology that way. I mean, I don't know how much time they necessarily need in terms of preparation, which might make that a bit more complicated.
I think the first idea makes a lot of sense. To quarterfinals onwards, you're most likely to have mostly Premier League sides, and then you're going to have like one or two Championship sides, one or two lower league sides, and you can then just do it then. You can make the extra expense to set up at those grounds if you're only doing it for eight rounds.
Yeah, are still going to use the same argument. It's so, like, well, if it was in before the rounds,
we
would have been through.
But that's the problem. This is the inherent problem with technology in football. This is why I've always been, as much as I can see the benefits to a lot of it, it's always been like, well, you can't apply it equally. One of the beauties of football, one of the reasons football is the best game in the world and the most popular sport in the world, is because it's basically the same in the Champions League final, World Cup final, and then when you're playing it, Sunday League. It's give or take a few trappings, it's basically the same game.
And so if we think VAR might have a loose future in the competition, the FA Cup at least, is there any verdict on Marco Silva at Everton? Do we think this is going to be wearing thin?
It's just so ironic that it might be set pieces that do for him, because this is like the bread and butter of all the of the Sam Allardyce and his entourage of supporters,
specialists
such as like the Richard Keys and the Andy Grays, who are quite vocal in their criticism of Marco Silva for reasons related to how Sam Allardyce was dealt with by the club and just like let go. Silva's in good company for having struggled with the issue. I think Guardiola said that he only understood English football after a Swansea Palace game the 5-4 win, in which he realised how important winning the second ball is.
Yeah. But Marco Silva, it's not his first season, is it?
True.
That's the argument being levelled, is Marco Silva, from his first first experience of the Premier League with Hull, he did work quite well, still went down, has somehow got this reputation that feel is an unfair reputation, whereas people like Sam Allardyce are pushed out of clubs.
It is creating tension within the supporter base as well. I think zonal marking also is another element of
started on that.
Set piece defending.
I think
in
if
the
you
dock.
Look at you look at what Silva's done, I think so Everton are moving broadly in the right direction. But the thing is you can't. It's very easy for someone like Sam Allardyce or David Moyes to come in and offer a one season fix, because they know English football back to front. They play a very, very low risk kind of football, and when you play low risk football, you can generally survive. And because you then set the expectations of low risk football, we just don't want to go down. We don't want to get humped every week. You can play very unambitious football, eke out a few big wins, and just sort of trundle along in the middle of the pack, and no one really cares. But when you try to play expansive football, what happens is you set the margins much higher. So it's not, even if you fluke a win 1-0, you play poorly and you win, it's like, oh, well, you didn't play well, and it becomes an expectation thing. So that's what Marco Silva's done. He's set the bar higher than just
he set the bar at 3 shots on target against the 19th place championship.
They were terrible. No, they were absolutely terrible.
I'm just being purely devil's advocate, because he's running out of reasons, isn't he, to back himself up.
I think it's a matter of time. I think they've got to give him a bit more. Yeah, they've got to give him more time to dig. Because remember, Everton
are
a club.
Of course they do, but he's going.
But it's about whether the situation becomes so bleak and frustrating. And Everton fans have have had their hopes dashed, really. This Mashiri age was meant to get them closer to the big six, but they're nowhere near at the moment.
Yeah, they're worse off than last season, first games. The current favourites to win the FA Cup with BetBull, which is at the time of recording and before Monday night's draw, are Manchester City at 7-4, Manchester United at 7-2, Chelsea at 9-2, Wolves at 10-1, and Spurs' worst nightmare, Crystal Palace, at 14-1. But moving on to... So we've looked at the magic, and we've looked at these the giant killings.
Oh, shout out Newport, by the way. Another... They held Borough. 57 places behind Borough, they held them. They come back to a replay. Last year, they did this again.
Is this just an excuse to wheel out your prediction?
I did say they were 1-1, but I wasn't actually going to bring that up. But now that you mention it, yeah, I did predict that they'd draw 1-1. No, it's just, they did this last year. They beat Leeds in the third round, and they took Spurs to a replay. And they lost to Spurs in the replay in the fourth round. Last year, they beat Leicester. Now they've taken Borough to a replay. Can they go one better? They're really, really... I really hope they do. It'd be a really great story to have them in the quarterfinals.
Newport to win the FA Cup.
Come on, Newport.
But to do that, they have to beat Mr. 100% Ole Gunnar Solskjaer,
who
can't lose and he can't even draw at the moment.
The greatest manager in the world.
Jesse Lingard, again, dances all over the Emirates.
Murder on the dance floor, baby.
Which was quite hard to take, I think, for the Arsenal fans. But someone else that stood out in a new role, if you will, was Romelu Lukaku, who celebrated his... assist, fair play to him. I believed it was good enough to stand and deliver.
The first one was very good.
The first one, and then it was the second one, I think, where he let Jesse Lingard moonwalk while he was just standing and taking praise from his teammates. But we've spoken about Lukaku before now in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's team, and the fact that he wasn't used at the start. Martial and Rashford undroppable in what they offer. Lingard again proving his worth in that. What is actually a false nine role, I think, in the sense that he's a midfielder playing in between two strikers. But was that the exact performance Lukaku needed to deliver to make OGS think twice?
Well, it's one of these, another one of these, and we did discuss this last week, I think, with reference to his...
Well, I wasn't here.
You should have listened, mate.
Should have been.
We should have caught you up. We did reference this in relation to these sort of special performances that now and again crop up, one of which he actually came against Arsenal quite a few years ago against Everton, where he just dismantled them from the right wing in a 3-0 win for Everton. There was obviously the win over Brazil at the World Cup, where he just excelled in this sort of... as really a system player, because he's kind of cutting in, and on this occasion was actually instrumental in the pass before the goal, where, you know, we've known Romelu Lukaku not long enough to know that he has that centre forwards mentality. So you wonder whether this role would satisfy him in the long term. But nonetheless, he has shown he's able to fulfil it there with two really clever passes.
Yeah, I'd say
the question is just whether if he's happy to do that long term.
I think, if anything, his skill set is much better suited to playing that role, because he's a massive guy and has had to play up front, his best performances, as you've mentioned there, have almost come. Yeah, he can play up front against the smaller team.
There are these special occasion performances, though. I can't recall a time where he's played there over an extended period of games, and that's the...
No,
that's
so what I'm saying thing. Is Lukaku will play and can just play up front against most teams.
Yeah.
But then his big six record is always thrown against him, saying, oh, you can't play that. But that's
very
because
true.
They're difficult games.
Yeah.
And his weaknesses are exposed in that, whereas this new role... And Solskjaer looks like he's going to be playing two up front. Man United were... That's what their fans bleed for, is this two up front counter-attacking team.
Yeah.
And it suits Lukaku better than being a front man that has to play consistently with his back to his goal.
Sorry, just before Mo cuts in, even against, if you recall, the win over Liverpool last season... I think he did set up both of Rashford's goals in that sense, but that was through a different kind of sort of playmaking with adept flick-ons. So
he set up Jesse Lingard's winner against Chelsea. He's good. He's good on this right-hand channel role. I agree. We haven't seen him do it consistently, but that's partly because he's your centre. With Everton, he was like, he's our centre forward. We have to play him up front. So they didn't really have cause to play him out wide for a while, except when Martinez was there and they had Andy Johnson playing as the... Was it Andy Johnson? No, it wasn't Andy Johnson. Who was it? Oh my God, I can't remember
who
it was.
Naismith, probably.
Yes, it was Naismith. The Highland Hidiguti playing as a false nine. You know, they so United actually have the ability to play Lukaku there wide full time. Like they can do that. And so I think he could get a run in there. I agree with you. I think that's absolutely, it suits him much more. I mean, he is huge, but he plays more like Rashford than, you know, Drogba is his hero, right? And it's ironic because he absolutely is terrible at doing what Drogba was great at, which was holding the ball up back to goal, you know, working in tiny, tight spaces and getting stuff off. He's much better in acres of space, running with the ball free with freedom and cutting in field and then using his intelligence to pick passes or to take shots. You know, so it was this formation United are playing suits him perfectly.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It's worth noting that it's not quite the same as those previous performances that we've mentioned, where it was kind of like a front three with him on the thing. It's this split striker system. Solskjaer tends to wheel out against the big clubs.
Which every big club is wheeling against the other big club.
But I would say the nuance here was that he did just plop Lukaku right behind Kolasinac and gave him something to think about.
Anyone that watches Arsenal means the only place, and again, against Chelsea, Arsenal were balanced because they had another fullback that knew how to play fullback. When Kolasinac is the only fullback available, then Arsenal will just gear everything towards that channel, which means he has to really advance. And Solskjaer was clever enough, and I'm not saying that everyone spots it and implements a plan that well, but Arsenal are so predictable when Bellerin is injured. That all you have to do is put a player there. And Lukaku was the perfect player for it because it's on his weaker side in the sense that you can cut in. And the reverse ball to Alexis Sanchez was great, teed up Jesse Lingard perfectly. So in saying that, Solskjaer got his tactics spot on, basically. Yeah. He absolutely nailed it. So if someone's consistently get 8 wins in a row, no one's ever done that for Man United, tactics spot on game by game, when does he get the job? When do they offer the contract?
Let's see how he responds to a loss. That's what you have to say, right?
Well, let's see how he responds to even going a goal behind, because wasn't that the other stat? They've not even been losing it.
They're playing very well. Let's see how he responds to adversity first, because he's got everything rolling and they're playing brilliantly. And I would give him the job right this second, but, you know, I love Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, so whatever. But you have to wait and see. Let's see how he responds to adversity. When United go behind, if United play Liverpool, for instance, and Liverpool score first, what happens? Does he fold? Do they come back into the game? You can still lose to Liverpool. Liverpool are a better side than Man United, but can you make it a competitive game? Can you give them problems? Mourinho was terrified of Liverpool. Every time they played, you know, it was like, and you know, he got a win against them last season, but mostly it's been like, oh God, Liverpool, he's been terrified of them. So can you go at them with a sort of confidence? Even Alex Ferguson, to be fair, was scared of Liverpool, but can you go at them with confidence? Can you go at Man City with confidence? Can you play, respond to difficulty? Because right now they've done well. They've won games. The big two games against Arsenal and Spurs, they've won them handily, really.
They're set up. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's tactics and what Man United fans have been asking for is tailor-made to going in front. Going in front just is absolute dream scenario for everything he wants to do because look, we're behind, we have to attack. No, they've got him bringing on Rashford and Martial like 70 minutes. You want a counter-attack? Let's make that even more petrifying.
He's doing everything that Man United fans want. He's diagnosing games correctly. It's not just him. It's Mike Phelan, the whole team. But that whole team is doing an excellent, excellent job at managing Man United. But like I say, I think I would consider, you have to consider them serious candidates, because anyone else coming in, they need time to settle in, they need to bring their own people in, need to get the squad on side. That current coaching staff has the perfect mix of United legends and actual great coaches, and coaches that know how United play and have that, how United set up, and their best players set up as well. Because you've got to look at United's best players, with the exception of Martial, it's Pogba, it's Rashford, it's Lingard. It's guys that came through the youth system, albeit they got Pogba in from Le Havre. So it's guys that the coaches at United, like Mike Phelan, know how they play. You know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer coached Pogba when Pogba was in the reserve team. They know how they play. So there's this sort of, it's all sort of set up, but they have to see how they respond to adversity, defeats, Because they will lose. They will lose games. There's no doubt about it. They're not,
it doesn't look like it.
I mean, yeah. No, look, they're not going to win every game. They will draw games or lose games. Let's see how they respond.
Yeah, coming up now, let's pick out where they might lose. Burnley at home. That's probably 9 in a row. Leicester City away in the Premier League after that. Leicester are bizarre to predict. They've already beaten Man City and Chelsea.
You couldn't predict that one. That could honestly go either
Fulham away will look like another win. Yeah. But then they have PSG and Liverpool at home.
Well, there's no Neymar, so he's going to miss that first leg. So I would back United in that first leg. Whether they can make it through Paris is another matter entirely, because PSG are much better at home than they are away. But you could back them to do that. Liverpool, though, that's the big one. That's because
with Neymar, then PSG, that looked like there was no chance. Neymar, it's like it's not even necessarily a question of the quality that PSG have, because on paper they should still have enough to put United away.
Though. Yeah, they haven't got midfield.
Yeah, Tuchel's desperate for a midfielder. Probably will end up with one after the window shuts.
He said, "I've been expecting Paredes for 2 days, and I've looked in the shower and the changing rooms, and still not here."
They need someone, because they can't put Marquinhos on Pogba. That won't end well.
Dani Alves been playing midfield as well. He's 35, isn't he?
Kylian Mbappe has enough in him to destroy Phil Jones, reduce him to atomized dust. So it's I'm not saying PSG are going to get blown away now because Neymar isn't there. But Neymar on his own, I'll give you an example. Neymar was terrible at Anfield when PSG played at Anfield. Absolutely useless. Still created a goal out of nothing. Pulled it out, ran through the middle of the Liverpool team.
And who scored it?
Yeah, Mbappe. But my point is that duo is lethal. They can be playing terribly and they'll pull a goal out of thin air. So having Neymar out of it, he's, whatever you think of the guy, he's the second best player in the world. He's phenomenal. So having him out of the tie is huge. Yeah.
It's a morale thing as well. And as much as it gives Man United a morale boost, it will decrease the morale among that PSG team as well.
I think Liverpool is probably where, even if they get it to Liverpool, that's where it will stop at Liverpool. I think Liverpool are
a bit too good. It won't be 47 wins in a row for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Just a quick diagnosis of Arsenal players getting injured every 2 minutes.
Oh, they need a centre back, man.
They need everyone.
They need a defence.
Bellerin holding out long term. Socrates, I think it was not confirmed, but more reports coming out that it's like a month. Koscielny didn't break his jaw, but
God, that was nasty, wasn't
still
it?
Be, God, that was so horrible. That's still hard to get over, especially for a defender.
You can't go into every.
You're going to be second guessing every headed ball. Well.
Yeah. Quick overview on what
I mean. Maitland-Niles looked good at right back. That's a good sign. You know,
he did, but he's also the one who plays Sanchez onside for their opener.
He looks good because he's very good in a 1v1 duel and had to do a lot of them against some very good players. Yeah. Him and Pogba had a nice few little battles where he won.
Yeah.
But as I said at the beginning, he doesn't play fullback.
Yeah, no, he's not. So, he's not right.
It's interesting to say about a player who has probably spent most of their senior career in that position. But
again, when he played left back, he played like an inverted, drifted inside and actually carried the ball. Whereas what Arsenal need from their fullbacks is just stay wide and be an overlap, and he's not quite grasped that. And that's why Arsenal don't play on the right.
I think he will eventually, but no, they need a centre back. They need a centre back they need someone who can just be fit. Like, all their centre backs are kind of erratic and injury prone and whatever. They need just someone who is just not going to get injured. That's the main quality. Who can we look for? Someone that doesn't get hurt. Just someone that can constantly be in there as a centre back.
Worth their weight in gold, types of defenders.
Jenny from Getafe. I don't know what his scores is. 25
Gary
million
Cahill's going to get a call.
Gary Cahill, I can't imagine. Arsenal just need to keep buying 30 plus year olds until they go into administration. But a team that might beat them into administration is Spurs over the road.
Oh, yes.
and not financial administration, but just complete dejection. That was an awful display, wasn't it? And it was, people are saying that it's because of the 7 changes Maurizio Pochettino made. 2-0 down inside 35 minutes. Kieran Trippier crossing his penalty into the stands.
Yeah.
The perfect reaction from that girl in the crowd, which was probably my favourite bit of the weekend. Just the huh? And obviously on a podcast, I just reenacted it perfectly, but you're never going to see it because this is an audio podcast.
It was perfectly reenacted.
But 7 changes, 799 days since Conor Wickham's last goal. Benteke back, Crystal Palace are going to steam up the league now with some actual strikers.
I don't know, man. I'm hesitant to say that. But
they are two pretty inconsistent forwards. They need goals desperately, and you hope that for Benteke's sake, when he comes back, he gets that goal early. Otherwise, it's just going to be a monkey on his back and it could be a long end to the season for him. Nice to see Wickham score, though. You could absolutely see what that meant to him.
Yeah, that was a really nice moment. I thought VAR was going to ruin it. but then it didn't ruin it because
it sounds ridiculous because you take away the three of the four best players in any side and you see they're going to suffer, right? So no Kane, no Dele, no
Ericsson
Son. Ericsson didn't play at the weekend, which I mean, I thought, what? Like, surely, what else are you playing for, man? This is the only trophy you're going to win the rest of the season.
Well, Pochettino doesn't want to build egos.
Play your main man. I mean,
it's not going to help them.
this is the problem with Pochettino is, as much as he is doing amazing things at Spurs by keeping them competitive with absolutely no help from Daniel Levy whatsoever, at some point you got to stop disregarding the domestic cups. You got to stop that stuff, man. You need to go try and win one. I think
building an ego for a team that probably doesn't have one.
Yeah,
that's true. The thing is,
yep.
Perhaps they need a bit of that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good point. When they got knocked out against the League Cup, he was like,
"Yeah."
In the Mourinho era, we won the League Cup, and then we felt unbeatable.
Because you could certainly say that his outspokenness and disregard that he expresses for these cup competitions is a way of really insulating himself from the criticism he faces relentlessly over that lack of a trophy.
So just to round up the FA Cup stuff, obviously plenty did happen. Betball odds before the draw has been placed, we should highlight. Man City at 9-4, Man United 4-1, Chelsea 5-1. Can we see? Is it going to be one of those? Because the thing is now there's quite a few Premier League sides out, and it's just those three really.
I think
no Arsenal, no Liverpool.
Depending on what the draw is, obviously, but I can see a Manchester final between those two. I mean, City are just the. There's only one side as good that could challenge City in terms of general quality in England, and that's Liverpool, and they're already out. So City, I can't see anyone getting in their way. I think they'll make it to the final, but regardless of the rest, Chelsea, I mean, who knows?
Without Wigan in the competition, it looks like it's going to be Man City's to lose.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
Chelsea are losing Hudson-Odoi.
Yes,
Their three... Oh, that was such a dry game for the first... Higuain debut was like, okay. I thought he got a lot of more praise than he actually
deserved. The penalty incident was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Ross nice Barkley's reaction.
Yeah. Why don't I get offered penalties when I started? But they were obviously trying to make this six-month loan deal for Higuain just as fruitful as possible. Like, just score now, Gonzalo. Yeah. Just get it out of the way.
You have to wonder what targets does he have to meet before they'd make that commitment to pay quite a hefty fee for a player entering his peak years.
The twilight zone, Higuain is. But I think that is a perfect time to move on to what will be the Squawker Betball Deadline Day Bonanza Special is what I've now coined it as. And that's what it will be. And we said Chelsea have got that, made that signing. Higuain is in. Hudson-Odoi might be going. But again, just sort of circling back to Arsenal and their problems.
You were scrambling about for a segue there.
Yeah, many, many, many.
No. That was flawless and seamless. People will realise that. And tell me afterwards as well. But they've yet to make a signing. And we've said that, well, they're out of the FA Cup. Europa League, we don't know what's going to happen there. They could get a tough draw, but that's Emery's competition. But top four for all of these managers is the thing. And they're the least likely, according to Betball odds at 7-2, to make top four.
Yeah.
But they're looking. Denis Suarez has been mentioned. That now seems non-existent.
The problem is, it seems like they have spent the entire window chasing these targets with an eye for a kind of long-term sort of plan. So the Denis Suarez would appear to be the replacement for Aaron Ramsey. Unai Emery says he needs a winger. Says he needs a winger, and that would explain the Ivan Perisic one, which I think as a neutral fan without a horse in the top four race, really, I'm kind of pinning my hopes on that Ivan Perisic making deadline day exciting, because I think that could really stir the pot in terms of the battle for the final Champions League place. The problem though is that none of the transfer targets they look to be in the process of signing address those defensive issues that we've we've spoken about earlier. So, and I think that's where they will fall short.
The best form of defense is a broken offense.
Perisic is not having a good season, but he's obviously a very talented, game-breaking kind of player. You look at his pace, you look at his ability to dribble, finishing, two-footed, you know, so you can see where he'd
two-footed and one-headed as well.
Yes.
He scores a lot of goals with all parts of his body, which is my favourite
thing. Arsenal really only have the one dribbler right now, and that's Iwobi, and so they need more. So you could see the advantage there. Denis Suarez is very, very talented and just needs the right scenario, right situation for him to thrive. You can see where he fits because the way Arsenal clearly, again, like Man United, Arsenal do well playing the diamond. They play very well in that system. They can't have Aaron Ramsey be the only guy that can play that number 10 role. Clearly, Mesut Ozil plays it with a different kind of energy. That's not what they want.
Yeah.
Denis Suarez is basically very much like Aaron Ramsey. And with Aaron Ramsey leaving for Juve or supposedly, I don't know if that's made official yet, but you can see why they'd want Denis Suarez, like you say, that again fits as well. I think
Nkunku is the other one that's been done as a loan deal, which worked Emery at PSG. All of them are one size fit all wingers. They're versatile.
Yeah,
and that's dangerous. I feel Arsenal lack a lot of specialists in their squad, and none of those players are known for being. Specialist is one area.
Perisic is a bit different to the other two, to be fair.
Like, he's different to them, but he's still like, we can play him on the wing or up front. We know he's going to put in a good shift. And again, I'm not saying they're bad players in themselves, but the problem with Arsenal is that they're so one-dimensional because of the lack of any real pattern of play apart from overlapping Kolasinac.
I was just about to say, I mean, you would be interested to see his partnership with Kolasinac on getting his head on the end of like a few Kolasinac crosses. But
yeah,
I mean, like I say, this is...
But there's no diversification.
It's just going to lead to even more congestion in the sort of...
Yeah, just funnelled down there.
That is Kolasinac.
The way that I would see Perisic fitting in that Arsenal side is because Lacazette, by the way, against Man United, was unreal. And in terms of what Emery wants from a striker and what people...
He was the best striker on the pitch.
People ask, and it was frustrating for someone that wanted him to do well as well, that his flick led to that third goal that Pogba just swallowed up the whole pitch with one stride and they scored. But his partnership with Aubameyang, what they both offer as a duo is what Arsenal need. So it looks like Perisic, but the only player that Kolasinac overlaps in the Arsenal team is Iwobi. So then you have someone's going to miss out, and this is what I mean about if Kolasinac is your only option, then you need to play Iwobi left wing, but then that means Lacazette, Aubameyang, Perisic fill spots. That means no Ramsey. I just feel Arsenal are going to be struggling the second half of the season, one because of defensive injuries and a lack of plan in attack.
The worrying thing about all the reports you're reading on these transfers is that most of them contain the line Arsenal are looking to agree a loan deal with an option to buy in the summer. You wonder whether that's going to be the sticking point that causes these deals to collapse. Sees Arsenal empty-handed.
That's why the Suarez deal, because Barcelona want to sell him now, and Arsenal are like, well, we want to loan him and then have a buy option maybe. And Barcelona were like, no, take him now. And maybe there was rumours that the loan with the buy option was fine, but then Barcelona had to renegotiate a contract with Suarez. I don't know, it's very confusing. But yeah, I would agree in general, Arsenal need players. And like you said, I agree. I thought Lacazette was phenomenal. I would argue the best striker on the pitch. I think they need to find players to complement him. He's exceptionally good. He can do everything. He can defend, he can dribble, he can shoot, he can pass. He's really, really, really good. They need to find players to compliment him. Aubameyang obviously is fantastic as a compliment to him. What they could do is, or should do is, whatever, look for either a third forward to compliment them or...
That would be Perisic.
Yeah, and then Denis Suarez is another one you think you can look at him to compliment. I think maybe that's how they're building their who can compliment these two strikers we have. It's like, okay, look, we're not going to fix our defensive problem. We've got too many issues there. Who can we build? Who can we find that will compliment these two forwards? Because they are so very, very good. And, you know, vast majority of teams in the Premier League, you can beat them by outscoring them. In the big games, would one centre-back make a difference for Arsenal? I don't know. It's hard to say. But I love the way Emery's built the side going forward, and I think it should have enough quality to overwhelm everyone. Who is in the Europa League? Who's really good? Napoli, I suppose, are the best team left in the Europa League apart from them.
Chelsea. They've already beaten, though.
I'd back Arsenal to beat Chelsea. I think Napoli maybe would be a problem, but I think... you know, he's got to win the Europa League. He's not going to get into the top four through the league. I think he needs to win the Europa League. And I think you signed Ivan Perisic gives you a big chance to do that. He's a difference maker, proven in cup competitions, proven in big games. You know, I can see the logic.
I want to just move on now, conscious of time, to sort of a review and what to expect based on what we already know about January and what we think will happen on deadline day. So just got some sort of quick fire questions about the impact of what this deadline day will have. And again, there's so much left to actually be called. It looks like it could be exciting, the Perisic stuff as well. And the quick mention of Rabiot sort of saying, do I want to move to Spurs or not, is another thing to look out for. But so far, which January signing would you say is going to be the most influential on what you know? And who's going to be the biggest flop? Will, start with you there.
I kind of feel like Higuain could be both. not both either. Like I say, the final Champions League qualification spot does seem to be the most hotly contested thing up for grabs in the Premier League, and Chelsea are struggling for goals right now. Higuain could provide them, or he could not. So
4-1 with Betwell to open the scoring in his what all should be his first Premier League game, and Chelsea are 13-8 not to finish in the top four. So it's going to hinge on that. But someone that will be looking to stand in his way now, which is another January signing, is Bournemouth. Another clever move, it seems, on paper, for Chris Meppham. Another player coming good from Brentford. As I said, will be looking to slot in alongside Ake and the like to stop Higuain in that game. Anything to say on him? Could he be the most influential? It's hard for a centre-back, I guess.
He could be very, very useful to Bournemouth because, I mean, if you look at the one thing Eddie Howe's side they've always had problems is, I mean, they've got Simon Francis and Steve Cook back there, and those guys have been with Bournemouth since, the League Two? Mm. They've been there, and, you know, it's admirable that they've managed to come to the Premier League and continue playing well, but they are very clearly the two big weaknesses in that Bournemouth. Well, I mean,
this is bad. I can't remember which one exactly was ruled out for a long while. I see them as Bournemouth, and they coexist as the same player.
Yeah, and then
but one of them suffered a major injury.
You have a lot of respect for them, the fact that they've played up, but they need to upgrade on them. Meffin could be a huge upgrade on them. He's very useful. And, I mean, you know, like Ake. Ake wasn't like a massive, like everyone's like, oh my God, he's going to be a must-hit prospect at Chelsea. Yeah. But he's very talented and he fits what Eddie Howe wants him to do. So he's actually he's really, really good for Bournemouth, like consistently so. And so I think Meffin could be really important because it will help balance out Bournemouth in defence, which is what they need. I think Higuain's going to be good. I think he'll get in the rhythm. I think him and Hazard, it's a dream partnership because Hazard just, when he's on the left, he creates chances for fun. His dribbling is so good. And when he knows that there's a striker in there that will take advantage, I bet you will see Hazard's approach change. He'll be looking more for him. He'll be looking up.
That's the thing is, he said that if the striker I play with only runs in behind, I'm in trouble because he loves those little interchanges.
Higuain can do both.
What I was about to say was that what was evidence against Sheffield Wednesday was Higuain's willingness to drop a bit deeper and link. And Hazard would have been licking his lips watching Higuain, despite his touch not being perfect.
And
not scoring, Hazard will identify that and say, yeah, that offers just enough of Giroud for me to be happy enough of Morata to make Sarri happy. Because Sarri himself said, I thought Morata fit Chelsea's style. He just told me he wanted to leave. So on from that. And
I think Higuain would be good. Mm. Yeah, I think it's hard to look past Higuain for impact because he's a striker. He's going to play alongside Eden Hazard, who's world class. So I think Higuain will be the guy. Flop though, I don't know.
Is Nasri going to be magic man for West Ham?
Oh, no, that's not the thing. I was going to say, I think Nasri, right? That's a good shot, but flop, because as much as it was great, debut assist or whatever it was, he's Samir Nasri. At some point, it will go off the rails because he just always does.
He's worked well in short periods of time with Manuel Pellegrini before. Though.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
The problem is with West Ham is it's just difficult to put your finger on what they're actually playing for. And therefore, like, what influence on the actual, on the rest of the season can Nasri have? We haven't seen too many of like the striker signings that clubs battling relegation often make.
We mentioned Saka earlier.
Well, Jermaine Defoe's a bit too old to move now to Premier League clubs. So.
And he's gone to Rangers.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why he's a bit too old for the Premier League now. No, it's funny.
Scored 12 minutes into
it. Two of the best signings in the
Ryan Babel, one you could
make. Oh, he looked very good. Yeah.
That's true, actually, Babel. Well, the thing with Babel is I think he'll be good, but I think Fulham are doomed anyway because I think
this is why I was so bad.
Which is so weird because their transfer business was actually very good. It was very, very spread out. It was diversified. They didn't just buy all the same of one player.
It was very expensive.
It was expensive, but it's just so strange. No, I think the two best signings of the transfer window are signings that aren't even going to happen. Obviously, I think Pulisic going to Chelsea, much as I don't like that he gets in Hudson-Odoi's way, he's a very, very good player. And I think Frenkie de Jong going to Barcelona is another really good one. They're signings that won't happen until the summer.
Yeah, they'll both happen in the summer.
Yeah, but I think for now, I think Higuain. I think you've got to look at Higuain. I think him and Hazard is a dream partnership. You know, to wrestling fans out there, Chelsea, you know, have Triple H up front if they put Hudson-Odoi, you know, Hudson-Odoi, Hazard and Higuain.
Double H-H-O. H-O.
All right, come on. Don't ruin my fun.
No, I'm kidding.
With your facts.
It is funny, but I also... being a cynic.
Also, they're probably going to sell Hudson-Odoi, so...
Yeah, so it'll be Willian, HHW. Final little thing would be looking forward to the summer. Yeah. Obviously, I mentioned Rabiot there, contract running out. Might not move now. PSG are desperate for midfielders. Forgive him.
They have to forgive
Coutinho,
him, sure.
Barcelona thing is really odd. Hazard also keeps talking about Real Madrid. Ozil doesn't look like he has a future at Arsenal. Could even be... I don't see why that... I think he might play a part in the Perisic deal because Inter Milan were linked, so there might be something
that
there.
Does, and he is kind of an Inter kind of player. Like, he's very talented and just sort of wayward in personality, which kind of fits what Inter do. So I can see that. And he would be amazing in Serie A as well, by the way.
Yeah, I think he's...
And Neymar back to...
He's primed for quite an interesting move, Mesut Ozil, because you would think that he would not have to make necessarily... You can't see him necessarily making a step up. I mean, you've seen Juventus linked, but I don't really know where he fits in there when they've got, like, Dybala.
It would have to be Dybala moving on, probably.
So you could see him moving to quite an interesting club.
I think he'll do
well.
The
Hazard one, though, after years of sort of anticlimax, I think we might actually see come to a head due to the contract situation.
Contract, age, yeah. Good season.
Real Madrid, of the team that supposedly are meant to be like top dogs in the transfer market, haven't like flexed their muscles really in a while. And all the Spanish press are saying they're going to make a statement signing this January, presumably to lure a really highly rated manager in.
It's going to be funny.
Welcome gift.
Might be the most...
You could also see a big Man United signing or two this summer because, I mean, depending on what happens.
Whoever they back.
It's like, here you go, here's
your present.
You're at Man United now.
I mean, you look at United. United need a centre-half, need a right-back, maybe a backup left-back, maybe a defensive midfielder. Real Madrid, it's interesting they're still linked with Hazard because their most hopeful player, the player giving them hope right now, is Vinicius Junior. Now, it's mostly because there's no expectations on Real Madrid and everyone thinks they're going to lose every game and he comes out and plays without fear and everyone's like, oh, really good. So he's still, in a long season, he won't be ready to be their talisman yet, but it'd be interesting if they signed Hazard because that would literally just shut him down.
Well, they've got Rodrigo coming in January as well. Yeah, so maybe they just bin it completely off and play three teenagers.
They should sign Real Madrid as always. They just need to sign number nine. They need to sign some.
Although Benzema's recent performance, for a lot of players.
But this is Benzema.
This is for the people that know football.
Yeah, but Benzema's streaky, isn't it? He'll score goals and he won't score goals. I think Coutinho's a very interesting one because as good as he actually is, and he's phenomenal. He just, that, you know, in Barcelona's best 11, he's not in it. Simple as that. And they've signed Frenkie de Jong, so there's absolutely no chance they're going to 4-4-2-3-1 now. They're going to play 4-3-3. It'll be Busquets, de Jong, and Arthur or Rakitic or whoever it is. So they're clearly returning to their first principles. You know, Coutinho's not in their best side. When you've got 4-3-3 and one of those players is Messi, who always plays, you know, you need to have three players for two positions, but they want to sign a backup striker to replace Suarez. So.
Yeah,
Coutinho's going. Maybe he'll go PSG. Maybe they'll try and get the revenge for Frenkie de Jong.
But Neymar wants to go back, and then you've got all of that, and then you've got De Ligt, Frankie's mate, that will probably be the summer.
Yeah, he'll be
summer
the
showpiece.
Juventus will be in.
Although
for him, I think.
Ajax 6-2 against Feyenoord at the weekend.
Yeah, that wasn't very good, was it?
Wow.
But I do wonder, the Ligt battle's going to be interesting because Barcelona are obviously interested, but he's going to cost so much money. Man United, Rina Raiola links there as his agent, so that'll be pretty good.
That could be the first.
And Juventus?
You said Man United need a centre-back.
Yeah.
That could be the one that they go to.
I mean, he'd be perfect.
But that's the summer, and all we care about is deadline day in January. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, Deadline Day will be sponsored completely by BetBall, and we have loads of content planned throughout the day. If you want to download the BetBall app, please make sure you're 18 plus and gamble responsibly. Visiting begambleaware.org for more information. But thank you for joining me, Mo.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining me, Will.
My pleasure.
We'll see you on Deadline Day, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.